order the Senate Committee on General Government. My good vice chair, Senator George, will get called into service at some point in time because I will be running to Hearing Room D to testify on a priority bill of my own. So we'll be just coming and going and racing here and there and everywhere. It is something I'm going to probably ask Judith to remind me to repeat in 10 or 15 minutes. I'm going to go back to my motto, fly or die. If you want your bill to go places, don't talk it to death. Okay? You can see the length of the agenda today. We do have a quorum of the committee, and so I'd like to open a public hearing and hear Senate Bill 8, and I'm asking Judith if she'll talk about Senate Bill 8 to remind us about this wonderful bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate Bill 8 creates the Oregon Military Emergency Financial Relief Program and the Associated Fund. It appropriates monies to the program. And in fact, if you look on your original bill, there is a blank in line 19, which will be filled in. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so Ways and Means will fill in that number. The measure would declare an emergency effective July 1st, 2005. You have before you the Dash 2 amendments. Those amendments direct the Oregon Military Department to adopt regulations instead of rules because that's the way they operate there. It appropriates monies to the Oregon Military Emergency Relief Fund, and it exempts hardship grants from state taxation. We have a no revenue impact on the measure, and as I said, this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Judith. Senate Bill 8, fairly clear. Is there somebody that wants to testify on this? Very quickly, it looks like my favorite, Colonel Mike Caldwell and H.A. McDonald would like to make quick.
Huh?
As represent? Oh, I didn't even see her. Come on up. I'm sure you want to talk about everything. Again, the rule is the longer you talk, the shorter amount of time we have to act on these bills. So.
That's right. We're moving on.
Thanks.
So we'll let the boss go first, right, you guys? Okay. I expect
Thank
you to
you
nod.
Very much. Thank you for that honor. Chair Shields and distinguished members of this committee, thank you for letting us be here today. We are so pleased and so honored that this great Senate has worked so hard to support our veterans and our military with 370,000 in our state now. We're long overdue in doing for them what they've done for us and securing their future like they have all secured ours. Should be a top priority. And on behalf of the House Committee on Veteran Affairs, we just want to tell you that we support this bill, we thank you for this bill, and we're looking forward to passing it through the House.
Real quick, you're fine with these amendments, Dash 2 amendments?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Mike, let's...
No, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director, Oregon Military Department, we support the bill. I have Judith and I didn't have a chance to talk about this, but in one of the amendments on line 6, it talks about ORS Chapter 316. I'm going to assume that is a tax that's relating with the tax issue because most of our stuff is in 396, 97, and 98.
It's not a problem. That's a tax.
Okay.
That's right.
Reference.
That's what I assumed. That's my only comment, and we support it. Thank you.
Mr. McDonald.
I represent Oregon Veterans, American Legion, Disabled American Veterans, VFW, Ex-Prisoners of War, Military Officers Association of America, and the Military Order of World Wars. We support the bill if you include the reserves. They are not second-class citizens. The Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and Air Force have all called up reserves, and this fund should include the military reserves that have been called up.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have the same problem with my bill, and I think that's a legitimate concern to address this and make sure that we do have the guard and the reserves included in.
The guard on this.
I have a suggestion. Why don't I pass this out of here and let Representative Nelson fix it over in the House?
Thank you.
That's fine.
Okay.
I have
a feeling she'll do that.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Is that okay, Senator George?
Good.
Any other discussion? This will be an occasion in which we can get, if you look at this agenda, you know how busy we are. We can have you take care of some of the stuff on which we agree.
I'm happy to, and we're all happy to do
okay.
that. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Okay. Is there any further discussion on Senate Bill 8, the amendments that we've been talking about? I guess I need to close the hearing if there's no further discussion and open a work session, and I'm asking for a motion on amendments to Senate Bill 8.
Mr. Chairman, I move dash 1, right?
2.
Dash 2 to Senate Bill 8.
Senator George moves the amendments to the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 8. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move Senate Bill 8 to the floor with a due pass as amended.
We're going to Ways and Means.
Oh, Ways and Means. Okay.
With that strong due pass, right?
With a strong due pass.
Okay. Senator George moves Senate Bill 8 with a
as amended
to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. It's gone. Let's now do Senate Bill 9. Judith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Pardon me. Senate Bill 9 creates the Oregon National Guard Memorial Program and establishes the associated fund. It appropriates monies for the program and defines the terms eligible member and family member for purposes of the program. You have before you the Dash 1 amendments that similarly direct the Oregon Military Department to adopt regulations instead of rules, as is their practice. It appropriates monies to the Oregon National Guard Memorial Fund and exempts benefits from state taxation. We have a no revenue impact on the measure, and it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And there is a sign-up sheet. It looks kind of similar to the last sign-up sheet. It has two guys named Caldwell and McDonald on it. Without Nelson, but who cares? I have a feeling she's coming anyway.
Chair Shields.
Let's not change the order. It works. So.
That means I quit talking quickly. Chair Shields and members of this great committee, thank you for this bill. Senate Bill 9 meshes with the consideration we've had in the House in our bill called the Emergency Relief Fund. I think they're very similar. We support this fund. The fund in the House, I believe we've funded to $1.2 million at this time for consideration. We're happy to work with Ways and Means on further development. We have located money, and we thank you. We are so grateful. And just a quick story is the story of Senator George was there. I recently did an auction for a colonel, a retired colonel who was losing his home. A woman called from Eugene and said, "Let me send $5. Where do I send it?" And I gave her our address, a Fund for Hope, to help our Colonel Reiser. And she said, "You know, I've stood on the corner in Eugene, Oregon for a year with a cup trying to save my house." I can't think of a better way to thank that woman for caring for others. There are many just like her. So on behalf of the many, many members of our families, of our military and our veterans, we thank you.
Thank you. Mike?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. We support the bill. However, I must say that it's not in the governor's budget. We support the concept. I think it's one of Ways and Means, and it happens to be in the confines of the $700,000 that the governor has allocated in our budget for National Guard issues. And if it fits within that, which I'm sure we can work that out in the committee and the Ways and Means, then we're all for it.
Okay. Mr. McDonald?
Same remarks on this bill, only we'd like to include all servicemen. If a serviceman is killed in action, no matter what service he's in, whether it's guard or reserve or active duty, they should all receive the same stipend for either killed in action or wounded in action.
Okay. Am I out of line, given our workload, saying the same thing I said before?
What did you say before?
What? Yeah. You. That's a nice way to confess you're tardy.
That's right.
Because I'm sitting next to an old guy today.
Which side? Oh, well. She does not have any bills in this committee.
She's insulting you, Senator Starr.
I've been called worse.
Happy birthday, Mr. Chair.
I'm not talking old, I'm talking experienced.
What I said before was that given our load and given Senator Representative Nelson's eagerness to get a hold of some of these issues, and given that Mr. McDonald has that concern, I thought we'd send it over there and let them take care of it.
I think we can do that.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? If not, I'm going to close the hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 9, and look off to my right again like I did before.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I hope I get it right this time. Senate Bill 9, I'd like to move the Dash 1
amendments. It's the Dash 1 amendments this time that we are approving. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If not, so ordered. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would recommend that we send Senate Bill 9 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee, and that we recommend that they favorably view the bill.
Okay. Senator George moves Senate Bill 9 to Ways and Means as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objections? If not, so ordered. Let's go to Senate Bill 10. Hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Member. Senate Bill 10 creates a Veterans Service Officer Expansion Program. The original bill says in the Department of Administrative Services. It creates the Veterans Service Officer Expansion Program Fund, appropriates money to the department for the program, and declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2005. You do have before you the Dash 1 amendments. That, in fact, directs the Director of Veteran Affairs instead to establish a Veteran Service Officer Expansion Program and replaces all the references to the Department of Administrative Services with the Department of Veterans Affairs and appropriates monies to the Oregon Veterans Service Officer Expansion Program Fund. We have a no revenue impact and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, you want to talk on this one?
I think my colleague, Representative Nelson, as well, but yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'm going to bring all you legislative types forward on this one, then I'm going to adjourn it and defer to another thing for my fearless majority leader who'd better not leave too long because we're going to use you in a minute, okay?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from Senate District 16. I feel positively underdressed testifying on a patriotic bill next to Representative Nelson. I am here to share with the committee an experience that I had in my district with the county veterans service officers. We convened a group of veterans, there were more than 40 in the room, desperately in need of services, and they were there offering overwhelmingly positive testimony on the quality of service that vets received from the county veterans service officers. And I want to mention in this setting particularly Katie Harris and Jim Palmer. These folks are taking home records on the weekend. They had gone back so far as to sort out a benefits package that was due to a World War II veteran. He had been denied for 50 years. And through just the weekend work of the veterans service officers in my district, they were able to help get benefits for this gentleman. These county veterans service officers are the main avenue for vets to get help with benefits and a link for them to other community services. As our veterans continue to come back from Iraq, we are finding that the veterans exceed the capacity and there is little or no opportunity to do outreach. In small rural counties, such as some of the counties I represent, the county veteran service officers are lacking even the basic tools to navigate the complicated VA benefit system. Because of lack of funding, they have no internet access, few staff, few hours. We have an office that's only open 2 days a week, and Katie Harris is currently working only 20 hours. So we estimate that the county veteran service officers are only reaching 8 to 10% of the veterans in the area, and there are often multiple hour waiting periods for those that do seek services. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I could go on and on. We took several hours of heart-wrenching testimonials from veterans desperately seeking the services. They understand that there are benefits in a number of places, and they don't have guides or the tools to navigate through the morass of state and federal bureaucracy that separates them from the benefits that they have earned, in my opinion. And so I'm here in aggressive support of Senate Bill 10. I hope that the committee views it favorably and votes it on through the process as a tangible way of thanking our veterans. There is a lot of conversation in this building right now about what we owe our veterans. This is a way to put our money where our mouth is, and I hope the committee looks favorably on Senate Bill 10. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I hate to do this to you, but I have a question.
Don't tell me I testified on the wrong bill.
No, you didn't. I wouldn't do that to you. Have you heard a mix of information on money that's come to these guys and not got to them and so on and so forth, and how do you view what we're doing here, and how do we guarantee that money that goes to those county service officers doesn't get lost with budget cuts and shrinkage here and there and so on?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I heard are very nimble public servants who have used any tool at their disposal to cobble together the resources adequate to try to approach the task at hand. In some cases, we heard that counties were less or more willing to provide some level of county support. I'm pleased that Columbia County has stepped forward with tangible financial support, but I think that these folks have looked under every rock to try to find available resources to address a mounting problem. We did not hear testimony the night that I convened these folks in St. Helens about funds being diverted. What we heard was there was such a paucity of funds, there was hardly anything to divert.
And,
that's the issue.
And so I am afraid that I can come with only, and I shouldn't say afraid, I am a reporter, to say that I am coming only with the laudable and the good about this program, and particularly to state that at a time when many people undervalue public servants, people who have chosen public service as a way of life, that it is my experience universally that these county veteran service officers go above and beyond the call, because in many cases they are vets themselves and they understand the minds and the hearts of the people that they are serving, and they do so at cost to themselves. So in this particular instance, I know of no complaints about the lack of sideboards on the money, but I would think that if this legislative body were to look favorably upon funding county veteran service offices, that they would want to know that there were adequate sideboards and that this money that was appropriated was used exclusively for the benefit of our servicemen and women who have given so much to this country and I think deserve at the minimum our ability to help them navigate through the benefits bureaucracy.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. I just want to go on record for everybody that's here saying I believe that any money that would go to the county service officers will more than be replaced by the money, by the benefits that they will get for veterans here, there, and everywhere, which will take them off of other caseloads at DHS and other places.
Mr. Chair, by your leave, I would share with you that we heard testimony to that effect with the gathering in St. Helens. I took copious notes. I had staff there taking notes. I believe that the hearing was recorded. And should you want us to identify the specific testimonials to validate the point that you've just made, I would ask my staff to make that effort on the committee's behalf.
Well, that might be relevant at another time, and I don't want to give you that extra work now, but I would urge you as one of those deities on the Ways and Means Committee to carry this story. I mean, I'm very serious. Mm-hmm. You want to save money around here? Spend some money on this project, and you'll find savings over in DHS. That's just my belief.
Mr. Chair, Pastor Shields, you're preaching to the converted, sir.
I get no respect today. Amen. Representative Nelson, I'm under the gun here time-wise. A few quick comments, and then I'm going to recess momentarily so I can get Senator Brown out of my hearing room. You know, that's a nice way of saying she gets to go next. Go ahead.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Senator Shields. Happy birthday to you.
Anything to delay the work.
Senator Shields, Chair Shields and committee.
I have to make it brief. You notice that?
This is very brief. But I just need to explain to you that over the previous years, we have been funding the county service, the county veteran service officers at a .2. And we're expecting a .2 of a person to handle 40,000 clients? I don't think so. So I couldn't agree more with the great and wonderful Senator Betsy Johnson. She tugged at my heart. She's right on. We have made certain, and we will continue to, as we support this bill, be certain that this money may not be used for any backfill at county levels of any sort, that the money is directed to the 40 county veteran service officers who will be employed in greater assisting our veterans. Also need to say, out of the million troops who've been sent to Afghanistan and Iraq, we have 10,000 in the Northwest. And everyone needs to understand that we have over 200 who are returning, who are amputees, 30 blinded, and many who need risk assessment for their psyche, mental concerns. Not one person goes to war whose life has not changed. So we need individuals who are close to them, close to their home, to help them with their needs. Thank you so much for this bill. We appreciate it.
Before you leave, I'm going to ask you to stay for just a minute, because the next person up that I want to come up is Paula Brown from the department.
Okay.
And if you have time, I'd like you to stick around so you can step back a minute. I do want to say something while you're moving back there, and that is I happen to have a nephew in Iraq right now. So
will you let him know we're grateful?
Where did Senator Brown go now? Okay. What am I doing? I'm closing. Just for a moment, I'm going to close this hearing so I can get Kate Brown in here, and I'm opening a hearing on Senate Bill 964, and I'm giving the good senator a chance to talk on 964. And Representative Rosenbaum as well.
I think
okay.
Representative Dingefelter as well.
Dingefelter. Okay, we'll have a senator and two reps flanking the senator. But you can't outflank this senator.
I can. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 21. I'd like to welcome my two colleagues from the House that are here to testify, and we really appreciate you giving this bill a hearing. As many of you know, it's a very historic week for the Oregon Legislature. For the first time, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means is holding open public conversations about budget priorities in each of the major issue areas. The curtain is being pulled back and the light is being cast on a process that was really once shrouded in secrecy. In this time of fiscal restraint and increased attention to accountability, all tax breaks should be under consideration, should be viewed as part of the entire budget. Just like important programs like education, health care, and public safety are being reviewed to make sure they are achieving measurable outcomes, all tax breaks should be evaluated under this very same microscope. For this reason, I have brought this bill to you for your consideration. The bill has three major components. It gives the Secretary of State and the Audits Division authority to conduct performance or program audits of tax expenditures or breaks. The purpose of the audit is to get measurable, verifiable data to evaluate whether or not the tax break meets its intended public policy purpose. Second, it directs the Secretary of State to establish the rules and criteria for objectively measuring specific economic, employment, and other outcomes. The goal here is to finally answer the questions as objectively as possible if a particular tax expenditure is actually generating the jobs or investments that it was intended to generate. Third, the audit will look at whether or not the agency or entity administering the tax break is doing so economically and efficiently. As we ask our government to operate efficiently, we need to hold the dollars not collected through tax breaks to the same review as the dollars that are spent on services such as schools and programs for seniors. There should be periodic audits of tax breaks to make sure that they are achieving their identified purpose, whether that is helping to create jobs or allowing more Oregonians to become homeowners. I anticipate you're going to hear from a variety of folks, some in support and some in opposition, but I would just argue that this is very important. I think it's a very pragmatic approach and will move us forward in this debate. I know that concerns will be expressed that the Secretary of State's office could use these audits for political purposes. From my brief stint on the audit committee many years ago, I'm not opposed to outhouse audits versus in-house audits, i.e. having the audits be outsourced. So I think that would be a solution to that issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Outhouse, it's all the same.
And I
can't credit under a privy.
You're turning into a punster, Senator George. But I haven't got privy to that information, so. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry. That's what my mother used to say. You're very sorry. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I actually have to apologize. I need to attend a meeting outside of the Capitol, if I may be excused. Thank you.
We all know where you're going now.
No. Well.
It's not an in-house meeting, so what is it?
I'm not telling.
Don't ever open yourself up like that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members of the Senate General Government Committee, it's a pleasure to be back in front of you again. You're seeing a lot of me this week. For the record, my name is Jackie Dingfelder. I'm State Representative from House District 45 in Northeast Portland, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 964. When the economy soured in 2002, as you all know, because we were here, the legislature was forced to hold five special sessions to address the loss of revenue to the state. The 71st Legislative Assembly drastically cut the funding of schools, health care, public safety, and other critical programs. The result, which I know is nothing new to the members of this committee, is that nearly 100 school districts in Oregon have chopped days off the academic year, weeks in some instances, because they lack the funds to keep their schools open. Many others have ended valuable programs like foreign languages, music and art, speech and debate, library support, and physical education. Thanks to these cuts, the ratio of students to teachers in Oregon is among the highest in the country, exceeded only by three other states. More troublesome, we have the second most crowded elementary classrooms in America with an average of 24 students per class. Thanks to these cuts, more than one-third of Oregon's high school students drop out and never receive their degrees. I know that's a fact that none of us here in this body is proud of. And also, thanks to these cuts, our school facilities are desperately in need of repair. Oregon ranks among the five worst for the proportion of schools that have crumbling roofs and bad plumbing. We rank among the worst three for general environmental conditions in our schools. And I had the privilege of sitting for 2 years in the Portland Public School Bond Task Force, where we reviewed the condition of every school in Portland, in the Portland Public School System, and it was quite a learning experience for me. Also, these cuts, through these cuts, scores of thousands of working poor have lost health coverage under the Oregon Health Plan. Hundreds of police officers have lost their jobs, and innocent people have suffered and died because the state stopped helping them get prescription drugs. Even though in previous legislative sessions we have aggressively cut budgets for school kids, seniors, and public safety, we have shown little interest in ensuring that the billions of dollars we give away in the form of tax breaks ever meets basic performance measures. As a member of the House Audit Committee, actually Representative Rosenbaum and I both serve on the Audits Committee in the House, we help scrutinize government spending to expose even the smallest of inefficiencies. But we do not currently scrutinize tax expenditures. That was one of the first questions I asked as a new member of the House Audits Committee. We seek to ensure that each tax dollar we spend on programs yields the maximum possible benefit for Oregonians, but we do not look at whether the money spent on tax breaks is benefiting our society as a whole. Oregon's tax expenditure report, as I'm sure you're all familiar with, is a good first step. However, simply reporting this tax expenditure appears to achieve its purpose is not good enough. We need to go further, and Senate Bill 964 provides one means to correct this fiscal irresponsibility by requiring that the Secretary of State's office audit tax expenditures in the same way that we scrutinize state budgets. Also state agencies, all the state agency budgets, boards, and commissions. Like any other government spending, tax expenditures are a way in which the government allocates resources to serve Oregonians. And as a member of the House Audits Committee, I urge you to support Senate Bill 964 to ensure that Oregon's taxpayers' dollars are spent wisely. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Hello again, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I am Diane Rosenbaum, State Representative for House District 42 in Southeast Portland. I'm also pleased today to appear in support of Senate Bill 964. Senator Johnson was up here a few minutes ago talking about looking under every rock for available resources, and I think that, in fact, that's exactly what this bill is about, and it's about a very, very big boulder that we are not currently looking under and not having adequate tools to do so. And in these times of scarce resources for education and health care and public safety, we cannot afford to let any stone go unturned, but particularly not one that represents billions and billions of dollars of taxpayer money. I can tell you from my own experience, and I've served here from 1999, that the attempts that I have participated in or watched to deal with the tax break issue are really woefully inadequate. In 1999, I served on the Revenue Committee, and that was currently chaired by a Republican, Ken Strobeck, who did a valiant job of attempting to go through the tax expenditure report and look at every single tax break that's on the books. But what happened, as I'm sure you would guess, is that every time we had these on the schedule, the room would fill up with people who would come forward and tell us that these were the greatest thing since peanut butter, and that if we tried to do away with them or change or limit them, we would be devastating some particular industry or segment of society. And when that's all the information that the legislature has to deal with, or a pretty cursory review that we have in the tax expenditure report, it becomes very difficult, and the political will is frequently not there anyway, to be able to take a serious look at these. So I think what Senate Bill 964 calls for is something that is very sorely needed. And I would guess that if our constituents knew that we had roughly half of every tax dollar going in one pocket and out the other, and that they were therefore having to shoulder more of the burden of funding schools and the other services that are so vitally important, that they wouldn't be very happy with us if they thought we were doing that without taking a good hard look at whether these laws were serving the purpose for which they were written. So for all of those reasons, I hope that you will look at this bill as something helpful. The House Democrats last week did unveil a package of proposals that included doing something in this vein. But I think the heartening thing is that this morning in a hearing room down the hall, the Speaker of the House also was asked a question about whether she thought that this particular tool would be a valuable one in the audits function. And she answered that yes, yes, indeed, she did think that it would be. And so it appears to me that this is something that Republicans and Democrats may actually be able to come together on and agree about. We're only talking about information. I don't see how that could be a bad thing. And I think the taxpayers of Oregon deserve no less. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, I just want to thank you. Certainly a valiant effort by a colleague of mine when I was in the House, Representative Strobeck, resulted in rooms full of people. Audits will result in tangible information, and that's the difference. So thank you very much for your testimony, and we'll...
I just want to make a comment. I am surprised that this kind of a bill has never come up before. I think it's awesome. I love audits. I love accountability and transparency, and both sides of the equation have to be looked at. This is a great piece of legislation. I don't think it's going to have any problem on this committee anyway. Thanks for coming over.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to close the hearing again on 964 and reopen our hearing on Senate Bill 10. We went to 964 to accommodate the senator and the representatives. What I want to do here is invite Representative Nelson back to the dais and Paula Brown from the department. And I want to invite somebody else up, and that's Jeff Hill. Is he here? Come on up. Donna, Representative Nelson, come on up. I have a great assemblage of people in front of me at this point. And I might even pull up another chair, since symbolically, at least, I wanted the senator back up here, and I thought she'd left me, but she's back. So that's not surprising. She always manages to be back. Thank you, Senator.
I went out home, took a rabies shot. I'm okay.
Okay.
You don't need him on this side of the building.
What we were talking about when we left, bluntly, and I have it up here, and some of you have probably seen it. On one side of this debate, there was a question about whether $100,000 disappeared of veteran service officer money.
Mm-hmm.
I have a sheet that indicates that no, in fact, the money is still there. On the other hand, if you look a little further, there were reductions in monies in the second special session and other places that look like ultimately $100,000 may have been missing in action. That seems to be an appropriate term. Okay? And so I haven't been able to sort out what happened in the past. I'm going to ask Representative Nelson if she has had any... Senator Johnson took a whack at the question, and I didn't have a chance to follow up with you having a shot at the same question, so I'd like to give you that shot. And then if Paula could, maybe she could respond, and maybe Jeff can shed some light as well.
Thank you.
All the suspects are at the table right now. That's why I wanted to do this. Go ahead.
I've never been a suspect before, so I'm excited. Representative Donna Nelson, Chair of Veterans Affairs Committee. Thank you, Senator Shields, because when I first heard this issue, it really was appalling to me to think that we had $100,000 that was designated for our 34 county veteran service officers, and the four are here with the Department of Veteran Affairs, that it would be used for something else. So I likewise have been concerned about that issue. That's why when we have had our meetings with the county officials now, the county financial officers and our veterans officers, we have told them that, you know, in no way will we allow these funds to be moved to a county without us attaching some strings to be sure they are, you know, put where we've directed, and that there is some measurement of what is has done with those funds as far as success helping our veterans. Paula does have the definition of what we had previously called confiscation. If I could pass this to her at the time, this time, please.
Okay, go ahead, Paula.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I think there that perhaps the first thing I should do is make some clarification concerning where there's any discussion about diversion or reduction of funds. I know that there has been a concern that when these dollars are passed through that the counties, that there has been some concerned that there be some assurances in place that once those dollars get to the county that they are actually used to provide direct services to veterans and not used for other county programs. That's kind of the one piece that I'm hearing if I'm listening to this. The other piece of that is the $100,000 or any other appropriated dollars to the department. One of the concerns we have with Senate Bill 10, and actually, if you'll notice, if it's all right, Chair Shields, I can. Okay, thank you. I guess first I should say that with the $100,000, there is some explanation that should be provided on how the funds were received and where the funds went, because the money does come in different ways to the department if it's designated specifically for the counties. The $100,000, would you like for me to wait for a second?
Go ahead.
Okay. The $100,000 that was received specifically for the counties, 100% of those dollars were passed through to the counties. As you'll notice, when I signed up...
Excuse me.
Certainly, Chair Shields.
$100,000. I want everybody's attention on this. $100,000, you said, was passed right on through to the counties.
Yes,
was
sir.
There any shell game where the Department of Veterans Affairs was able to, in some way, shape, or form, cover some of its reduction in funds that it had to take by using the money that was supposed to go on? I mean, sure, we can have a couple different funds sitting here, and you can say, well, 100, well, we did it. We, the legislature, did it. We fund shifted all over the place, didn't we?
Sure.
So we were good models. And I'm just asking, was there money that was kind of fund shifted in a sense, so that, yeah, on the one hand you can say this $100,000 went out, but maybe some money.
Oh no, there's no doubt about it. There were some budget reductions, some of those budget reductions were felt by the county, and I can go to that part now.
Well, you keep saying county, but let's use the right word. Those budget reductions were felt by the officers, the county veteran service officers.
The disbursements from the state are provided to the county for their services to veterans. Most of those are their county veteran service officer program. Absolutely correct, Chair.
So. I interrupted your sentence. You said there were reductions of funds to the County Veteran Services Office.
That is correct. When the department, I gave you the spreadsheet. I don't know that everybody has that. But as we began to go into various sessions, which is actually one of the issues we have with the bill as it's written with the amendment, but I want to make sure that I am clear about that. With the second session reductions, when we had to make those reductions, When we get a mandate or a direction for general fund reductions, the department needs to make a decision how that's going to occur. We value the relationship with the counties. So when we received the second session reductions, none of those reductions went to the counties. Those reductions went to general fund dollars that affected both the veterans service organizations, national service officers, and the department. It's one of the things that our director has publicly indicated is support of the county veteran service officers. Then when we moved on, we had another reduction that was mandated, and it was I can give you the exact figure. It was $16,472. When that reduction had to occur, that reduction was shared evenly among the department, the counties, and the veterans organizations. When we had another reduction that was actually an adjustment, and I can bring my budget officer up here and he can certainly explain this much better than I can. Those were some reductions that were really adjustments to the budget. And if you need further explanation on that, okay.
I don't need further explanation. Okay. What I want to do, again, I'm still trying to hurry today.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff, I want to get a little reaction from you, candid reaction. What happened at the county level? You're one of those county veteran services officers, are you not?
Yes, sir.
And what happened? What was your experience? Was it $2,002, $2,003? What was it?
Our understanding is this biennium we were authorized an additional $100,000 from the legislature.
This biennium. We're not talking about these special sessions dollars of the second reduction in two.
I'm not
trying
sure.
To figure this out.
I'm not sure what she's referring to.
See, that's a 103 that I'm looking at. Go ahead, continue.
Okay, for this biennium, that $100,000, we've not seen any payments in our counties from that $100,000 authorization. The only funds we've received from ODVA is the normal reimbursement authorized by statute, which is currently $10,074 per county.
Okay. Comments?
Actually, I would like to bring my budget officer up. He's okay. The one that makes the disbursement.
You can step back or okay, whatever. All I'm doing is trying to figure out what I've heard both sides of this argument. I'm just trying to figure out what happened.
Where the money went.
For the record, my name is Randy Basil. I'm with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs.
Slip closer to the thing, okay? Thank you.
Okay.
Randy?
Yes. Chairman, committee. Coming out of Governor's Rec, there was no longer a $10,200 per county.
In 2003. In 2003, there was no longer a $10,200 per county allocation.
Correct.
All right.
The $100,000 that the legislature put back into the budget brought it back up to the $10,200.
So there wasn't $100,000 extra dollars ever put in there?
Not an extra $100,000. It was $100,000 put in to bring it back up to the $10,200.
In other words, we decided for a while there that to do a person's job we would have maybe not two-tenths of a person, but then one-tenth of a person. Then we got generous and decided to use two-tenths of a person instead, again.
Senator Shields, committee, when we submitted our budget under agency request, we had actually submitted packages to bring it up to a $15,000 level.
We're up to three-tenths of a person.
Coming out of Governor's Rec, it was down to the, let's say, $9,000 level. The legislature bumped it back up to $10,200.
Excuse me, could I get clarification, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
When you say Governor's Rec, what are you talking about?
Governor's recommended budget.
Well, that's what I thought, but you need to be clear, sir.
Okay.
Just some of us that are listening in TV land don't know what you're talking about. So just want to be clear. Thank you. So the Governor's recommended budget in 2001 or 2003 that we approved had reduced that allocation by $100,000.
And then restored it.
And then we restored it.
Chairman, Senator Walker, yes, that is correct.
Okay, now I follow.
But it was not understood very clearly by service of veterans officers who thought they were going to get $100,000 of extra money to work with, which never materialized. That's essentially, Jeff, go ahead.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, we specifically asked the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs about the $100,000, and he informed us that that money was given back by ODVA to the Department of Treasury or wherever they give it back to as part of their budget cuts at a meeting this past October. So I'm not understanding what I'm hearing here today. Either they gave it back, or they didn't give it back.
I confirm that is what I also heard, that the $100,000 that was there was given back at to cover some of our cuts. Okay. We've aired this enough. I don't want to stay here all day. But I want it clear that we're not going there again?
That's right. We're not.
Representative Nelson, would you like to make some comments to just wrap this up real quick?
And I agree with you thoroughly, completely. That's not the way we do business, and we're certainly not going to go there again. We will have specifics on the attachments to these dollars. This will never happen.
Okay. With that, I'm going to let everybody slide back because I got an awful lot to do between now and who knows when.
Chair Shields?
Yes.
Could I ask the committee's indulgence for just one quick comment?
Okay.
When I came here, my position was to oppose this bill based on a number of factors. Since that time, I've taken a look at the amendment, which I think is a very good amendment by this committee. The only issue that would remain for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, for the record, these dollars are not in the governor's recommended budget. I believe I need to say that. The other item would be under Section 2, the director of Veterans Affairs may not reduce the payments. We would respectfully request that possibly the committee would consider some kind of language, including something that says, except as directed by lawful authority, in the circumstances that the department is mandated to take general fund cuts, that if we have to take a 10% general fund cut on $7 million, if the $5 million does go there, that if the $5 million is set aside and that cut can only come from the $2 million left for the department, that would be a $700,000 hit to the other programs. It's certainly a public policy decision, but that would be a large hit to a $2 million program.
I'm going to ask Representative Nelson to comment.
Senator Shields, this is a first for me, first time I've heard of this. We would not back that change to this bill, and
would you suggest we approve the amendment as it is?
I suggest you approve the amendment as it is, and we'll talk more with the Department of Veteran Affairs. We would not approve that action.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else? I got a list here. You all can talk on this bill as long as you want, or we can move this bill. Your choice. Mike, I say we can talk this bill more or we can move it. That's my opinion. Is there discussion in hearing? I'd like to close the hearing and open a work session. Excuse me, somebody wants to speak. Just remember, every second we speak, we don't move the bill. So let's move on.
For the record, my name is Matt McDonald, representing Oregon Veterans. We think by omission, this bill is a little unfair to all veteran service officers in that it does not include the 11 national services veteran organizations in the Portland area that have veteran service officers. So by this formula, you're not including them, and it would be unfair to those veteran service officers that are outside of the metropolitan Portland area. The second thing is on Section 2, we think that the Director of Veterans Affairs should have some flexibility, and this bill allows him no flexibility.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm sure that you'll have an opportunity with Representative Nelson to address that concern as well, Mr. McDonald. Senator Hurd.
We heard this bill the first time. There was someone that came up and also added about reservists that were not included in the bill. Did you make a note of that?
I think we dealt with that.
There was a note made about that. I guess the thing that bothers me a little bit about moving the bill is that I haven't gotten my arms quite around any wrongdoing. If there was really wrongdoing, then I think we need to understand what that process was.
At this point, Senator Verger, I feel like I've made my point and we've shed some light on this subject. Okay? I'm not wanting to point at anybody and say you're guilty of this or that or the other thing. I think at this point that's going to get in the way of a bill. and I don't want to get in the way of the bill. The light has been shed. If Representative Nelson or somebody in Ways and Means finds clear indication of some wrongdoing, they can deal with that. For me, because I really want to do this thing for the veterans, I'd like us to get it out of the committee. I mean, I think, well, a minute ago when Senator Johnson left, she said, I have a 4 o'clock meeting up in the governor's office. Got to go. I deeply appreciate your getting to the bottom of this. You know, well, we haven't got to the bottom. Who knows how far down the bottom is? But the issue is we've shed light on it. Representative Nelson and others that have been working with it says this is not going to happen again. We're going to be clear. And for me, though I haven't got my arms around the whole thing, I can't say who's saying what, who's got the high ground, what's valid, what isn't valid. I think we've shed enough light to get this thing going. And that's why, with your indulgence, I'd like to see us move on. But that's totally up to you to vote as you wish on this issue, Senator Virgin. And I hope you understand what I'm doing. In no way, Senator Virgin, do I not take seriously what you're saying. But how long would it take us to, and I'm using your words, Senator, how long would it take us to get our arms totally around exactly what happened? I'd be glad to give you the spreadsheet that I was given. Can I give that to you? Because it didn't answer questions very well, okay? And it seems that there was another $100,000 in the next biennium, and I don't want to. I mean, we could be here till midnight if I try to get my arms around this whole thing. Go ahead.
Well, I'm certainly supportive of the bills. I just want to be sure that we've tied down everything that needs to be tied down so that the right people are getting the money as was intended from any legislative action that is made. We all take an awful lot of time to go through and analyze programs and want to put people at the head of the line because of what their service. And so it's a little discouraging to me if that doesn't happen all the way through the process to the bottom line. So I'm certainly willing, and this shows no lack of support at all for the bill. It's just a matter that I hate to rush past things that may be in process, but if you'd like to move,
well,
I certainly would be happy to do that.
I'm convinced that Ways and Means is going to look at this some more, and Representative Nelson has indicated that she's going to be looking at it some more. I have a feeling that after the light we've shed on this today, and I'm not saying we've ended up with a conclusion, we've just shined a bright light on it, it's not going to go away. It's not going to be hidden.
Senator Shields, I probably have said this before, but I want to reiterate it again. They could not have given the veterans program to a better person than Representative Nelson. She will be at the forefront and loyal to the end. And I just, it was a stroke of genius that put you there. And every veteran in Oregon should be thanking their stars that they've got you there, because I know your ability and your leadership, and I sincerely mean that.
I agree, and thank you. With that, Senator George, I think we have closed, in case I didn't, I'm closing the hearing and opening a work session on Senate Bill 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sympathetic to what's been said, but we're talking about expanding services. I'm going to write a floor speech on this, dealing with a personal friend of mine that was able to access services that should have been in place for him years ago. The impact on his family is unbelievably beneficial to him because somebody finally got him connected with what he was in fact due. With that, I would be very pleased to move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 10.
Okay, you've just moved the Dash 1 amendments.
Mm-hmm.
Is there further discussion? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 10 is amended. I would recommend that we enthusiastically send it to Ways and Means with the appropriate recommendation as a do pass.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 10 to Ways and Means as amended with a do pass recommendation. Is there any objection? So ordered. I've been asked in a note to see if we can't
finish the hearing
on Senate Bill 964. And that's going to frustrate other people behind us in the queue. If those people that are here on 964 will be very brief, I will pull them up very quickly. Is Patty McGuire here, for instance? See, I think a lot of people have left thinking it's going to come up much later in the agenda. Who is here for 964 at this moment? Only one person?
I think there's somebody asking about
the telephone call. I tell them that I will return to this in
Patty?
I've been asked to do 964 real quick. I want to get you and anybody else that wants to deal with it up here now. What's your name, ma'am?
Marsha Kelly.
Marsha, come on up. So, and Lynn Lundquist was signed up. Is he around anywhere? If somebody sees him, no, you stay here. If somebody can get him. Is there anybody from Stand for Children here? What's her name? Damiana Merriweather? Mm-hmm. If anybody sees her out in the hall, or Chris Hoagland from Our Oregon, let's get them back in here. Okay? All right, what's your name? Chris, I'll allow you to come up too. Patty, I'm going to ask you to carry on real quickly on Senate Bill 964.
Mr. Chairman, I'll do the speed reading version. Patty McGuire, Deputy Secretary of State. Like Senator Walker, the Secretary of State loves to audit and believes expanding this bill expanding the legislative direction will provide us with interesting and fruitful audit work. We're especially pleased that this bill is an authorization, not a directive. The Secretary is concerned about a growing list of legislative audit mandates impinging upon his independent constitutional audit authority. I do want to say a word of caution about this bill to keep expectations in check. Cause and effect relationships are very difficult to prove through auditing. If a tax credit promised, say, 100 new jobs would be created, we'll be able to say whether or not new jobs were created and how many new jobs were created. We won't be able to draw a direct link to say whether or not those jobs would have been created otherwise.
Okay.
Where did
Senator George go?
Excuse
me. Go get Senator George. I am being called to another hearing room. And since I'll take over. You can take over. Go. Back. She loves audits.
So it may be that those cause and effect relationships are better drawn by an economist than an auditor, but we do support this bill and do believe that there can be some very useful information from it. I just don't want expectations to get out of line. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Ms. McGuire. We'll wait until the panel's finished and ask questions. Ms. Kaufman?
For the record, I'm Chris Coughlin, Executive Director of Our Oregon. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Our Oregon's a broad-based statewide coalition representing thousands of educators, seniors, parents, business owners, and people who care about and care for our state citizens. Our common mission is to advocate for stable and adequate funding for public services while ensuring efficient use of taxpayer dollars. We strongly support the new prioritized budget process being used this session as a step towards providing outcome-based budgeting in our state. However, we think this is critical to not only review the dollars spent through the Ways and Means process on schools, healthcare, public safety, and other government services, but also to give the same amount of review and scrutiny to all tax expenditures. Part of this review should include periodic audits of tax breaks to make sure the tax expenditures are achieving their identifiable purpose, whether it's helping create new jobs, allowing Oregonians to become homeowners, or other important public purposes. We support this bill because it clearly gives the Secretary of State and the Audits Division authority to conduct performance or program audits of tax expenditures. I will hand in some testimony that gives one example of a tax break that could be subject to such an audit, the life insurance investment income. Many of us use life insurance as part of our retirement planning or protecting our families, and federal and state governments have to recognize this as the decision that's important to support. However, there's also national press on companies using this to insure employees, some of which are no longer under their employment, but they continue to maintain life insurance policies. And then when those policies actually are paid out upon the death of that individual, that income that's recognized by the corporation is not taxable because of such a tax break. And this is a national issue, and I have some additional information on this. Obviously, there are situations where a business needs to protect itself from the untimely death of a key employee. However, articles such as the one that I will give you do raise some questions about the rationale for providing a tax break in all cases. A review of how such a tax break like this is used could be done now, but what's missing is the measurable, verifiable data that will allow such a review to be substantive, not cursory. The criteria called for in Senate Bill 964 to measure specific economic, employment, or other outcomes by which the goals and purposes of tax expenditures may be objectively measured would fill that void. In this example that I shared, the goal would be to see which companies are using this break for a valid essential business reason and which may be using it as a way to maximize their own revenue and detract from the efficient collection of tax dollars that our state depends on to provide the services that we all need. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kaufman. Ms. Kelly.
Thank you for hearing this bill. My name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. Our member organizations are the American Association of University Women of Oregon, Delta Kappa Gamma, the Salem YWCA, Oregon National Organization for Women, Oregon Women's Political Caucus, the Elder Women's League.
Did you have anything else?
And in individual members. So we represent about 8,000 people, but I promise not 8,000 telephone calls. We are also very excited about this bill. We've been following the tax expenditure report right here, an inch thick, plus since the 2001 session. The concept of a true evaluation of the tax expenditures is something we have supported since then. As you read through the report, you realize that many provide a public benefit. Many are designed for just a few small group of citizens. But you also realize that the people who work closely with the programs are the ones who, in the report, justify the expenditure. This is not all bad. People who administer programs should be proud of their work. However, as the state continues to fall behind in spending for programs that will aid our children's future or stabilize our working poor families, we need to look at all state spending. The audit process should provide that neutral separation for those who administer the program to train professionals to make sure that the state is benefiting from the investments made in the tax credits. During the current ways and means process, we are continually reminded that setting priorities is necessary in order to live within the resources, and we feel that setting those priorities for tax expenditures is just as important. One of the things about the ways and means process currently is that in the human services area, the priorities are being spent for only things that are in the governor's budget. Getting tax expenditures into a priority and maybe being able to capture some dollars back that are not being spent with as good a public purpose might get us back the 125 families a month who might lose domestic violence service. And I think that that's one of the things that we're aiming for. The property tax credits that affect the level of service that the local governments can provide are very good things to look at because our local governments are having problems living within the budgets that they have due to the other limitations in property tax exemptions and credits limit their ability to do something. So I think that a good objective look at the tax credits would be very, very, very helpful. Thank you again for allowing us to testify. I was not the expecting to be able to stay all this time because I have a board meeting that I have to go to as I have an elected position, and so I would have missed the testimony. So thank you for taking us semi out of order.
You're welcome. Mr. McGuire, I have a question before you step back. You indicated that the cause and effect relationships are difficult to prove through auditing, and that's best done maybe by an economist. Does the Secretary have the authority to draw on the skills of an economist in those types of audits, which you've never really ventured into before?
Madam Chair, in terms of authority in auditing, our constitutional authority is quite broad, and so I don't think that would be a particular problem. The difficulty is applying auditing standards, government auditing standards, and in that this calls for an audit. Economists aren't used to using auditing standards. You know, I guess it's a bit like asking a physicist about music. I do have a concern about that. We're certainly willing to work with the sponsors to find solutions to these issues, but I thought it was important to put in the record the expectations.
It's not as cut and dried as it appears. And I think that's appropriate. Now, I think it's a place to start. It's a discussion that's not been had before, but as you go through it, I think you may find that there are some other needs that you need to draw on other experts to help you in that assessment. Question from Senator Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for you, Mr. McGuire. Would you agree that every tax credit has gone through some process at some time and was approved?
Madam Chair, certainly. As far as I know, they all got legislative approval at some point.
Right, at some point. Would you agree or disagree that making some determination about a tax credit might reflect a philosophical position?
Madam Chair, Senator Berger, sure. I mean, I'm sure there are, certainly there are dozens of factors that go into any legislative decision, so certainly.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
You're starting to sound like a lawyer, Senator Berger.
So, yeah, I'm leading him into this, down this rose path. So in order to really determine which tax credits are good ones, you have to have some ruler here, some benchmark, something to judge this by. Let me use just a tax credit, the pollution tax credit. Now, the argument for the pollution tax credit, it, from one side, is from business who says we need to have this tax credit, and they give 10 reasons. The other side says, why do you give a tax credit? Because they're only doing what they're supposed to do anyway. Most of the tax credits, I think, run into this kind of dialogue. Representative Rosenbaum was here, and she said every time they tried to get one, the room filled with people who thought it was the greatest thing since peanut butter. So I think that the danger here for me is what form it would take, what is this being judged by, if you're going to judge whether those 100 jobs were tied into the economy, what I'd like to know, if you do away with another tax credit, how much are you harming the economy? What kind of position does it put jobs in? And that's a philosophical argument, too, that management and labor might have. So I think there is this is a very difficult challenge to just say you're going to go in and look at tax credits. And I think it's a burden, quite frankly, for the Secretary of State with just moving into it without a great deal of thought going into how it's going to be judged. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Berger, I didn't sense that was a question.
If I may make a quick response, Madam Chair. Senator Berger, I very much appreciate the comments. It would certainly not be our intent, if this is adopted, to rate tax credits as either good or bad, or that one is better than another. Our goal here would be to provide the Assembly with some hopefully unbiased information upon which you would make decisions about whether it is worth it or not. I mean, it would certainly not be my intent to come out and say this one's good and this one's bad.
Right.
I think what we would try and do is say this one may or may not have reached it the goals that it was set out to achieve, at least to the extent that we're able to figure out what those are, which is going to be going back in the legislative record at the time that they were created. I mean, your comments about how difficult this is, we understand and agree.
Madam Chair, yes. I'd like to just lift up one little scenario here. Let's take enterprise zones. Enterprise zones, where you are, say, in 3 years I'm going to have this, and I'm going. Mm-hmm. So are you going to take every enterprise zone, and you're going to say, company XYZ got this break, but they didn't do what they were supposed to do. Now, that's going to each company and evaluating whether their tax break was appropriate, did they do what they were told, and so forth. So I see it as a very heavy responsibility.
Mr. McGuire, you get to go to the Archives Building.
Yes.
That's my other favorite place, because to get the legislative history that far back for some of these, you've got to go to Archives. And one final question, then. Your analysis will be the... can be that the tax credit either met or didn't meet its expectation, or it can also be, as Senator Berger points out, indeterminate, because you don't have the tools necessary to tell you whether that tax credit has done a good job or not.
Well, and again, Madam Chair, I would get back to saying that the goals were met or weren't met, but whether the tax credit was wholly, partially, or not at all responsible for the outcome, I'm still not sure that we can make that connection.
Okay. Thank you. Did anyone else on the committee have any questions?
I do.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. I guess the question I have is, how much money are you going to go to the Ways and Means Committee and ask for to accomplish this task?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, we do not have a budget request attached to this. I mean, this is not our bill. We don't have a budget request attached to this.
Well, then what do you expect, Madam Chair? What do you expect the bill to cost for the Secretary of State to embark in this endeavor?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I mean, we will audit as much as you give us money to do, through the Ways and Means process. This is an authorization, not a directive, and so it could be that we make decisions to include in the auditing, the general auditing that's in whatever budget comes out of the Ways and Means process. If this is enacted, we may decide to do some audits of tax expenditures as part of our regular auditing budget. If this came with no additional dollars, there would probably be some work done in this area. It's not going to be a huge amount, because the amount of discretionary auditing we have left after doing the mandated auditing is pretty small. I would not expect great, huge results out of this without significant additional dollars.
I think I just have two additional questions.
Okay.
Next question is, so the answer is that in order to do audits here without any additional resources, in order to do audits in this field, you're not going to audit additional, you'll substitute audits that you would have otherwise done in other state agencies or other things. So is that that's where you're headed then.
Yes, sir. Without a larger pot, doing more things means the soup gets thinned.
Okay, then the last question. This bill requires the Secretary of State Audit Division, it looks like, to adopt rules to go through this process. What is the typical cost of a rulemaking process to the Secretary of State?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I believe that this would be a very simple process for us because and might not require any additional rulemaking. I haven't looked at that in depth because our rules include using the government standard. There's a yellow book of government for government auditing rules, which are national rules, and we adopt them en masse as the way we audit. And this comes out of the Government Accounting Standards Board, which directs government auditors on how to behave. And we think that the rules already enacted probably cover anything we'd need to do in this regard. So the short answer is it would probably require no more additional rulemaking.
Okay, well, that draws me to an additional question.
Okay.
Thank you. It seems to me that your earlier testimony said that the auditing of tax expenditures is far different than auditing state agencies and performance audits for state agencies and those kinds of things. It seems to me that the rules that you'd have to have to do this work would be significantly different than the rules you'd have to audit a state agency performance-wise.
Madam Chair, Senators, are not really. The difference is going to be for us the number of disclaimers we're going to need to include in whatever our findings are to say, action A was taken, result B was expected, something more or less than result B happened, but we can't say that it was A that created B, if you follow.
Thank you.
You have a question, Senator George?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've served on revenue, education, finance committees, several of them, ways and means. We've heard people come forward for as long as I've been here and made claims that there were all of these tax expenditures that were just absolutely being abused. And I've waited repeatedly for someone to come forth and say to Channel 2 News or whoever it is, do you realize what they're doing? When it all gets said and done, we get back to the point in which we say, you know what? I think every one of these things are probably necessary for the good well-being of folks in their home loans or their business in general deductions. And I'm just really curious, what do you think that you could accomplish that hasn't been accomplished by the efforts inside of the legislative process? What would be done differently? I know it's not your bill.
Madam Chair, Senator George, I believe we could bring to the process is a more thorough review of whether results are being achieved. When you look in the tax expenditure report, the level of review that goes on in there is pretty cursory. Now, are we going to be able to do that for every tax expenditure? Absolutely not. No. Can we target a few and look at a few and see if results are happening? Probably, but again, the connecting the dots issue is, whether new jobs are created by a growing economy or a tax credit, auditors can't say.
All right. I think that exhausts the questions. Thank you, panel.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate you coming up. We have two more people on this bill. If you could come forward, Damiana Merriweather and Lynn Lundquist. I'm going to turn the gavel over to the vice chair because I have a meeting in the president's office. And you have to bear with our committee today. Those of you who are new to the Capitol, we all have bills up and meetings, and we're just trying to do 20,000 things at once. So please bear with us, and I'll see you back here in a bit.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I guess, in this case, and member of the committee. My name is Damiana Merriweather, and I am here today on behalf of Stand for Children. Stand for Children is a nonprofit membership organization that helps people who care about children come together, advocate on concrete, lasting changes that improve the lives of children. And I am here today to express my support for Senate Bill 964. I'm not going to spend a lot of time reiterating things that have been said by people who come before me in advocating on this bill. Probably the natural first question that comes to your mind is, if you're a children's advocacy organization, why are you here on a measure having to do with tax expenditures? And many of those reasons have already been articulated by people who come before us. As we advocate on behalf of adequate funding for schools and find ourselves challenged to reach that funding level, as well as the other obligations that you as legislature have to fund, we are looking for better and more creative ways to identify resources that could be better spent on education than where they're being spent. And we think that a reasonable and appropriate review of expenditure via tax expenditure is a right and appropriate thing in terms of accountability and our faithfulness with taxpayers' dollars, both those we collect and those we return to them. And so that is why we're here. I know that there were, Senator Berger had several questions. In my past life, I actually wrote administrative rules for a state agency. So, Senator Starr, to your questions about that, many things, and as I read through this bill, many of the things that would have to be applied in terms of creating and adapting new rules would be very straightforward. So in terms of that burden, I think Patty McGuire was pretty straightforward with you as saying it wouldn't be a huge burden on that to adopt rules that would allow, again, this is not obligatory, but simply creates that opportunity for this function to be incorporated with other functions. So that's just my personal experience.
Question, Senator Starr.
Thank you. Clearly, there's a limited amount of resources available to Secretary of State to do audits. You know, is this more important than auditing the Department of Corrections and how they're spending money as they build prisons, or you know, auditing some other state agency that's doing various things looking for savings?
I think the Secretary of State makes Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, the Secretary of State makes choices every day on how they allocate resources in terms of the urgency of what should be audited next, and that would not change. But I think there are also ways that certain tax expenditures, which work in conjunction with areas of direct expenditure, would be a natural fit, and to fit those pieces in along with the larger scope of the related issue that they're looking at or the related department would not be necessarily a tremendous additional burden, and that they, of course, would have the discretion of discerning when those times and places are. But if there are natural synergies, I feel it's almost a shame not to have that as an option to incorporate where appropriate and within the resources they have. Of course, I would not stand here today and try to tell the Secretary of State which audits he should or should not do next. That's not my job, and I would defer to his wisdom on that.
So you don't have Mr. Chair, you don't have an opinion about whether the auditing tax expenditures is more important than auditing other state agencies?
I think that, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I think that accountability in all areas of expenditure for the state are important and an obligation. Obviously, some areas are more sensitive, some areas are more time sensitive, some areas account for much larger dollar amounts. All of those things are considered by the Secretary of State when he makes decisions about what he audits and when he audits, and I would not presume to rearrange that order for him. But we have an obligation to be faithful with every dollar that the taxpayers give us.
An additional question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. You didn't read your testimony, but I did. You talk about the $5.4 billion in schools isn't you know what that means to our school system, and I tend to agree. Is the organization Stand for Children doing anything that as it relates to the kinds of salaries that salaries and benefits that teachers get in Oregon, as we have the eighth highest paid teachers in the nation. When you look at salary and benefits, we have the eighth highest paid teachers in this nation, and we have the 49th highest class sizes. Is there not a correlation there, and is your organization working to maybe bring more alignment into those figures as well?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I am not well versed on the issue of teacher compensation. I would not present myself as someone who is an authority with the capacity to speak to all the complexities of how educators are compensated. So I don't feel like I could adequately speak to those issues based on my knowledge. But, of course, Stand for Children would be happy to come and talk with you about those issues and see if there's something that's not being explored that could be.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, it just seems the organizations here lobbying for a specific number for education, 5.4 or more, and you know there's costs that are behind that number, and it would probably be good for the organization to understand what it is that's underlying those costs and why it is that we pay our teachers in the highest echelon in the nation. And at the same time, we have the highest class sizes in the nation, 49 out of 50 states in class sizes. So I just would recommend that the organization look at all sides of the equation as it relates to school funding.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I appreciate that. Again, there are many complexities that go into every piece of the expenditures we do in education, from special education to rural school districts to educator and staff compensation, far more than I have the capacity to respond to here. I think that you are right. We have an obligation to be faithful in looking at every piece of those and whether we are making the most of every dollar that we spend. Beyond that, I can't comment.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks.
For the record, I'm Lynn Lundquist, president of the Oregon Business Association, and for whoever might have the sign-in sheet might notice that I checked neutral in the box, but we did feel we wanted to come in and make some comments about this bill. As you mostly realize, Oregon Business Association prides itself in trying to be a balanced voice for the Oregon business community, and that's always not easy. Just as in the business world, any successful business is willing to look at both the expenditure and the revenue side of their business. And we analyze that over time. And so we're not afraid of someone taking a look at the tech expenditures. In fact, they're not all for businesses, as you all know. Someone for every Oregonian out there receives a benefit as well as just the business community. But I think that task can be useful. It has some questions about it that I'd be glad to comment on if you have those further questions later on. I will tell you that in the middle of the bill there, that section in there, lines 11 to 15 or 14, something like that, is really the meat of the bill. And I think some of the words in there we need to look at very carefully. It talks about the criteria that you set up. That is not an easy task to do. I happen to be an economist by training, and so I understand that. And particularly the next to last word in the highlighted section where it says objectively measured. I think so Senator Berger rightfully talked about that some things are objective and even there'll be something subjective in that. And so we need to be careful on how we go through that process. So it's the point I'd like to make, it's very, very critical how that process would proceed. Should the state be jealously analyzing the revenue as well as the expenditure side? I'd say yes. We say that's right. However, that task is a very, very difficult task. And I believe what we're simply looking for here, and I hope the outcome would be if they were to go down this road, would be facts that we could substantiate. And I'm always one of opinion when something is analyzed that maybe I'm, you know, two people are different opinion on, as that analyzation goes forward, it's either going to make me a bigger believer in what I think is right, or it's going to change my mind. And I think a lot of these tax expenditures you're going to find they're useful. It's what we have some fear of, and I hate to use this word, but there is a potential to have sort of a witch hunt go on. and I don't think that should be appropriate. What gives us some confidence in that wouldn't happen, and I'm looking at all of you there in your positions as legislators. The key here, I think, is that if you look through the bill, it talks about the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. I think the Legislative Audit Committee has an awesome responsibility as this type of bill would go forward, because that committee, along with the Secretary of State, is going to set the schedules, who gets audited, and all that sort of thing. So I think that's belief that the legislature would not let that be a willy-nilly thing. Not speaking of any past Secretary of State or the present Secretary of State, that's just a potential that we need to guard against. So do we support looking at both sides? Yes. Is it a very difficult task? Yes. And it needs to be very carefully done.
Any questions, committee? Yeah. Thanks, you two. According to my list, that's the end of the people who would like to testify on Senate Bill 964. Is anyone else in the audience who would like to address this bill? What I'm going to do at this time is temporarily, if I understand this right, close the hearing on Senate Bill 964. And with the tap of the gavel, I will open up a public hearing again on Senate Bill 486.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 486 extends the tuition waiver program of the Oregon Military Department to surviving members of the Oregon National Guard who are killed while on active duty. The measure defines surviving family members, which include a spouse or a dependent of a member of the Oregon National Guard who indeed was killed while on active duty. And it would declare an emergency effective July 1st, 2005. There's no amendments before us on this particular measure. We have a no revenue impact. And a fiscal statement issued, you'll notice in your materials, the fiscal statement indicates that the change in the tuition waiver does not have a fiscal impact as it relates to Oregon National Guard members, because at present, indeed, the federal government does reimburse 100% of such tuition costs. So here we're talking about adding surviving family members. If you'll look at the bottom paragraph on that, the fiscal impact statement, you know, they indicate that the number of active duty deaths, as well as the number of surviving members choosing to pursue post-secondary education and where they pursue that, the costs associated with that, unfortunately, are unknowable at this time and, of course, hopefully extremely small. So that those comments come to us from the fiscal office. Again, no revenue impact and no amendments before us on Senate Bill 486. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
At this time, Colonel Caldwell and Mr. McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Colonel Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. As I've testified earlier back in February on this bill, we're certainly cognizant of the need, and we appreciate the legislature's thought process in looking at survivors of service members who have been killed and for their survivors. As was mentioned by your learned staff, the federal government, as far as tuition assistance goes, our tuition assistance legislation has basically been zeroed out. There is no money, the legislation's there, but there has been no appropriated dollars to service that, and the federal government has subsequently picked up their share and the majority of the load for soldiers. There is no federal program that I'm aware of to assist surviving members. If it is, it's certainly not a Red Cross type operation where it's granted or that sort of thing. Given what's occurred to us in the Oregon Guard, and I'll speak specifically of that, not the rest of the services, if this would have been in place during this present conflict in the Oregon Guard, we would have we've estimated that it would cost us about $213,960,000. That's as strictly as, and it is a very scientific guess, because we know how many folks have perished in our organization. We've made estimates on their families. We've made estimates on their potential use of this benefit if it was enacted. So I wouldn't put a lot of, I mean, it's very loose guess is what the best we could do. Having said that, it's not in the governor's budget. We support the concept, however, it is not part of the governor's budget, so therefore we have to remain neutral on the subject. Concludes my testimony. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Mr. McDonald?
Basically the same thing I said previously. All veterans should be included in this. I at one time was a casualty assistance officer who notifies next of kin with their member of their family killed in action. I'd hate to be a Marine casualty assistance officer and have a Marine spouse say to me, why does the National Guard get this privilege and not I? All veterans are veterans, and all veterans should be treated the same.
Okay, thank you. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Colonel Caldwell, I was distracted there for a minute as we were handing the gavel off. My understanding is that if this is available, other than the family members, there will be a match. Tell me what would be wrong with having this in place as it now stands. I mean, is it an advantage? Doesn't it do anything?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, you know, I think any benefit to a family member of their surviving family member is worthy, and I think is public policy. It would be my contention that would be something that the state and federal governments should do. Federal government chooses not to do that, and I think Senator Courtney in his wisdom and Representative Menace in her wisdom elected to take this task on. Certainly, there is no match that I'm aware of at this point. And we're talking about the legislation as it's currently written, or the current statutory language, allows for Oregon National Guard members for up to 90% tuition waiver or tuition assistance. This bill changes that to 100% for those current Guard members, mm-hmm. and also adds in survivors of those who have perished of the Oregon Guard. As Mr. McDonald has stated, it only deals with the Oregon Guard. I'm sure there could be programs worked out or the bureaucracies could be figured out to take care of other folks. We're not currently set up to do that, and we have made no estimates on that, to deal with Oregonians surviving members. And again, there is no match that I'm aware of. It's strictly be a state-funded item, and I can't tell you how many reservists or active duty. Precisely, it's around 30, 35 Oregonians who have perished in this current conflicts with Iraq and Afghanistan. And we've had 10 members of our organization, 8 members killed in combat, 2 killed in non-combat, while serving in the war zone in Iraq. So if you take those 10 numbers, if that is some sort of a norm, I certainly hope not. But in that case, with those 10, make it an estimate of 2 children. At some point, there would be that. There would be, as those children become of age to go to college, mm-hmm. that's what we estimated. And I think it's extremely difficult, as you heard in your previous testimony, is we're being asked to try to estimate something that is really unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be equally as good a way to do this with respect to some of the programs that this legislature enacted, I believe, in 2001, with respect to the college fund that the treasurer holds, and maybe there is something. I mean, I believe in this concept. It's just simply there is no money in our budget to deal with it, and we can't guess exactly what it would cost.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
Mr. McDonald, what about that concept of addressing this if we get this thing moved over and the House gets their hands on it, to idea of looking at some of these other mechanisms to fund this? I know it may be out in the future. It's listed here as indeterminate. But, Mac, how would you bring all the other folks that you're talking about into a program? Is there some sort of structure that would get those reserves in?
Well, we would... Mr. Chairman, Senator George, what we'd have to do is we'd have to coordinate this, because communications is the key, and it'd have to be coordinated between the reserve units, the regular units, And I think the Department of Veterans Affairs would be the person or the organization that probably should be the coordinating agency for anything to do with death benefits or wound benefits for Oregon veterans.
Okay, thanks.
Now, Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I would concur with Mr. McDonald's assessment of that. I think once you cross that line and you are in the veteran status and your loved one has perished, then I think they would clearly be the better agency to deal with that than us.
This bill, I'm sorry, I've been out of the room a long time. I think I got a bill through, one of my bills through another committee.
Congratulations.
I had to leave before I was sure. But this bill establishes a policy. We don't know the cost. I think we're in a position where we're allowed to pass it to the floor, and I would like to know what your feelings are about that as a committee.
You're looking at me. I would say policy-wise, I like the idea of indicating that this is what we believe. If that's all it is, it's still it's a statement of support, mm-hmm. particularly support for anyone who is going to be a surviving spouse.
I mean, these are not bills that I introduced. I am facilitator here, so I'm trying to ascertain the support level of the committee. Senator Virgin.
I think it's a very good bill, Mr. Chairman, and the reason is that if you look at the ages of the young people that are over there fighting this war, and if they don't come back, they leave a spouse that is now head of household. And I think that is extremely serious, not only from the spouse's viewpoint, but these people leave children, and the mother of those children or the father of those children, either way, are now left with that responsibility. I think it's a good bill. I would strongly support it.
Okay.
Senator Shields, Senator Virgin, would you support changing the National Guard in there to a member of the armed forces? So we're covering all Oregonians. I think we have to be fair to, you know, no matter what service they're in.
I guess my answer to that, sir, is that I'm not sure that the National Guard is treated quite fairly, but maybe that's just my own impression.
We're all in the military, and we're all the same. As far as I'm concerned, I spent 28 years in there, and I worked with all services.
Well, I was a military wife, so I fully understand the military. But people who go into the National Guard actually don't go into combat the way they're being used today, in my opinion. And I believe that we have a military, a career military. They go into it. They're ready and prepared to fight a war. And unfortunately, this war is being fought by National Guard people quite a bit.
And reserves.
And for that reason, I don't know. I'd have to think about that.
Certainly if we pass this or send this to the floor of the Senate, the debate can be had, as Representative Nelson indicated on the other side. And unlike the other ones that were going to Ways and Means, this one would probably go straight to her committee. Is there further discussion? I'd like to close the hearing on Senate Bill 486. Open a work session on Senate Bill 486.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's appropriate, I'd like to recommend that Senate Bill 486 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves that we send Senate Bill 486 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. And I'm going to ask Senator George if he'll carry it.
Mm-hmm.
We're just moving much slower than I thought. Senate Bill 667, I'd like to open a hearing on it. Donna Nelson, or Senator Representative Nelson, has left. Mr. McDonald, you're the only person signed up at this point to talk on this bill. Let's do this rather quickly, if we can. I'm going to ask Judith just to tell us what it does first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 667 requires any school district to issue a high school diploma upon request to any veteran who attended high school before serving in the armed forces, did not complete high school because of their service in the armed forces, and was discharged or released under honorable circumstances. It would declare an emergency effective on passage. This one would, in fact, cover any member of the armed forces would be eligible for this particular benefit. We have received a minimal fiscal impact statement on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. McDonald.
Senator Shields, this bill is almost identical to House Bill 2681 and 2850, which are identical bills. They've already been heard in the House Veterans Committee, and they've been made so anybody that leaves high school for any service and is in a combat zone will be awarded, at their request, a high school diploma. And I suggest that this bill you let die and let the House bill go forward.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. When you give me quickly the age that you have to be to go into the armed services.
You're supposed to be 17 years of age, ma'am. A few of us cheated.
Yeah, they may not do that today.
It is hard to do it today. But I guess okay. I'm giving my age away.
Okay, so you legally have to be 17 years
yes,
of age.
Yes, ma'am.
And you do
you
not.
You cannot
have
go
to
into combat until you're 18.
You don't have to have a GED.
Yes, ma'am. Almost every service requires either a high school diploma or a GED, depending. And the changes. It depends on how well they're recruiting. If they're not recruiting well and they need bodies, they may drop the requirement for a GED or a high school diploma. But I think you'll find that all services today, because of the complicity of the instruments we use in the armed forces, that you have to have a high school diploma or a GED.
Okay.
And it'd be a minimal impact on those people that get into the service that don't have one or the other. I mean, it'd be very few today, because I know of no one in the Marine Corps, which I can talk to specifically, they require a high school diploma.
Well, I signed on to this bill, but I'm now beginning to wonder why it's necessary.
Well, it's necessary for the at least for the Vietnam veterans, ma'am, because I had people in Vietnam that never got a high school diploma. In fact, I had kids from Tennessee never had shoes on their feet.
So they got past the recruiter.
They got
a GEDR high school.
In Vietnam, somehow they got drafted and they ended up in organizations. But it's the least needed for Vietnam. And, you know, once in a while, people do get past the recruiter and in the service underage or they fake. I had in the Marine Corps, I had a man go through OCS with me to get commissioned. And he had used his brother's college degree to say he was a college graduate, and they didn't catch him until...
Good grief. Well, I don't think we should award him with the high school diploma.
No, ma'am. But by the time we caught him, he had already had 9 months in Korea.
Other questions? Colonel Caldwell, do you want to comment on this?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, just to validate what Mr. McDonald has already said, the current standard for us in the National Guard is that you can join with a GED. The active duty Army right now does not allow that. They allow only high school diplomas, and all the other services as well require at least a high school diploma. A lot of young men and women join the National Guard with a GED. They go through basic and advanced individual training, get their certificates of training, and then they convert over to the active component. They will allow that. So it's education is a must, and being able to demonstrate ability is primary in this whole aspect. So it would probably not affect anybody that has been in the service since probably about 1976, 78, 79, right in there.
A quick question to cut to the chase here. Do we need this bill if the House bill's already passed?
No, sir.
Okay,
no, sir.
Then why are we doing this? All right. Let's close the hearing. 667. How about 679? Have we got some people signed up on this?
Yes, sir.
He doesn't want to move. He just wants to stay here. Let's see. We've got three chairs there. Jan Coleman could come up if he wanted. Tom Gallagher signed up next, and Betsy Johnson is gone. That covers that field. And I'm going to hand, I'm not leaving the room, but I'm going to hand the gavel to Senator George.
You can talk to Corey Strike if you're here for
a few minutes. Okay?
I'll let you three decide who's going to go first and then proceed. Go ahead.
Senator George, for the record, my name is Matt McDonald. I represent Oregon Veterans Organizations. Basically, I would only make one change to this bill. I think it's a good bill, but I would name the discharge papers that all services issue, which is a DD-214, and I'd put it in there by name, which would help the county clerk identify discharge papers. No questions. Go ahead.
Any questions for Mr. McDonald?
Well, I thought this was a privacy issue. Am I missing something here? I mean, it isn't that you don't want people to be able to get the discharge papers of people?
Ma'am, my discharge papers are in Polk County, and anyone can walk in there and say, I want Colonel McDonald's discharge papers, and then get it out, and could be used for identity theft. And that's why I think it's a good bill. This would restrict them from getting my discharge papers and using it for illegal purposes.
Okay, yeah, that's exactly what I understood the bill was.
Jan, you want to go next?
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk. Today I'm representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. I got the luck of the draw, you know. Anyway, as the county clerk, I'm here in definite opposition to the major. We are the keeper of the public record in the counties, and because of that, we feel that this has been recorded as an open record, and if this were to be closed, it would literally close the public records in most of the counties. There are approximately 31 counties that commingle the recording of the discharge papers, which actually we have more than DD-214s. We have honorary discharges, too. These are commingled with all the land records in 31 counties. So if you close the record, the public record for the DD-214s. In essence, it's going to close the land records, the public records in these counties until we can do something about it. There are some issues here. You know, if you're closing them, we have records that go quite far back. So at this point, we would have to probably put a staff person there to research all the records for people because these records are intermingled with all our microfilm and so forth and would cause definite problems for just the public doing their own research. So we would have to hire people to do that. We would have to hire people to actually go back to the old films and remove these records. In actually Washington County, over the last 10 years, they have over 1 million documents recorded with probably about 1,000 of these military records interspersed. So that somebody would have to go through and do all the redacting of those. Then we would have to pay to have new security films made and so forth. In Marion County, the recording head kind of did an estimate, and he figures it would cost $45,000 in that county just to recreate the security films. So it's, while we're not unsympathetic to the cause of the veterans, it's just a huge impact on us as far as the keeper of the public record. Also, you have to realize that these public records have been sold to a number of people. Certainly the land title company all have these on their records, and how can we go to a private entity and say you no longer can, you know, show these records? And probably the last thing I would say is we are doing this as a service for the servicemen. It was instituted to help them keep track of their papers. We don't charge for that service. It is totally voluntary on their part. That's probably the utmost thing to keep in mind here.
Any questions for Jan? Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure that I understand. If I come in and I want a land record, you go and get the land record. If I come in and say I want a veteran's discharge papers and I'm in no way related to the veteran, you can say, I'm sorry, but those records are not yours. So I'm not a family member. I wonder if it would be better for you if it were limited to only family members that could receive the record.
Well, the thing you have to realize is we have records that go way back to the forming of the county. And so these records in most counties have been commingled with the land records, and a lot of people come in and do their own research because they are public records. We have public stations for them to do that sort of thing. So if you have commingled records, at that point it would shut the record to those people doing their own research.
Okay.
Follow up.
What do you tell me, explain commingled?
Commingled means the military discharges are recorded along in the same record with all the land records.
Why?
Because that's what has been done in the counties. It calls for recording, and recording can be a mingled index. So that's what it is. Not all the counties have that, but the majority of them do.
Mr. Gallagher, I think you're going to help us.
I hope so, Mr. Chair, member, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. I was basically going to talk about ID theft and adding another category of records that can't be gotten at. But I had thought of a solution to this. If you turn to page 2 of your bill, and I think, again, we might have to make sure with counsel this would work. On line 22, another section of the bill of the public records law that says information submitted to a public body in confidence and not otherwise required by law to be submitted, and goes on to say it won't be disclosed unless it's in the public interest, would suffer from the disclosure. So what I was thinking is, on line 4, we could add information submitted to a public body, including a discharge papers, or however they would be properly titled, would be papers submitted in confidence, and then the county clerk would not disclose those papers unless it was in the public interest to disclose them. And it would be a way of giving them the authority to say, no, you don't have a right to those papers. They were submitted to us in confidence. I was asking, I think, Colonel, is it?
Yeah.
I can't remember where my DD 214 is. I think it's in the bottom of my drawer. But you could record them at the county clerk, and I think when people do that, they intend to have them kept there as a record for themselves, as a place they could go if they move or if their house catches fire. It's their safe deposit box. And I think we could check with counsel. Section 4 is intended to do precisely that.
Let me ask a question. Okay, first. Sure. I'll come right back to you. Jan, help us with this. My understanding, there's a lot of information that would, in fact, be very valuable to a person who is going to do harm to someone's credit that's contained in this. But how would you ever separate that other than if you took and set up a new database for new incoming?
That's exactly what we'd have to do. Your proposal would certainly work with a new database, you know, new record.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, we work with the old database, too, because when somebody came in and requested the record, you would ask them, this is personal information, what right do you have to it? Then you could refuse to disclose it.
Okay, that's fine if they're requesting to us, but we have, like I say, we have the public record, and we have people who come in and research the record on a daily basis, just come to public terminals.
They just read the microfiche?
Mr. Chairman, if this is okay with you, what we're doing right here, because I'd like to get to the bottom of it if it's okay with you. Because, Jan, what we're talking about is open terminals that people come in who can and access this. How would you do that in order to just stop it?
No. It wouldn't work. My way wouldn't work for those people to get to the open terminal. But look at all the public information that's already on that terminal. His identifiers may be on there 3 times, not just his discharge papers.
Mr. Chair, I've asked Senator George to chair this because I've been in about 3 places at once for the last 15 minutes. I'm just thinking that maybe a little short-term, very brief kind of work group might be able to figure this out. And if not, we're going to be in trouble with regard to the bill. I would like to invite Senator Betsy Johnson to come up. And then it would be my intention to see if we couldn't go ahead and put together some way of working out. And I don't know, is this your bill, Senator Johnson?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Would you be willing to pull these people together? I thought Tom had an idea that might be of help, and maybe Tom and these others could work with you to come up with a solution.
For the record, Betsy Johnson, State Senator, Senate District 16. I apologize, Mr. Chair. I, too, have been three places in the last 15 minutes. I would be very amenable to work with whatever group the chair or the vice chair, if the vice chair is going to assist us, would ask us to convene to work through this. I understand that the clerks have issues. I have spoken with Mr. Gallagher about his concerns. I also have been approached by a number of people who are quite concerned about the voluminous detail that are contained in these records. The ultimate goal here is to protect identities and to try as best we are able to keep confidential information confidential, and if a work group is a direction that the chair suggests to find a resolution to everyone's concerns, I would be very agreeable to participating in such a venue.
Any other testimony you wanted to give, or did I kind of supplant that with the idea here?
I think at this point we've gotten the chair's direction on what way you want to head, and is all I need to do, because I am a bit scattered coming from different places, is who all has testified, who all you would recommend be included. I can get that from the record, but if you or the vice chair have any advice, I would be very amenable to receiving that.
Well, I had indicated these fine folks and Tom Gallagher, who had spoke just before you came in, who had a brief conversation with me, and that covers everybody that's on the sign-up sheet anyway. So,
excellent, Mr. Chair. That's very agreeable to me.
Okay. That's what I'd like to do then, and as soon as you're ready, Senator Johnson, come back to us and we'll continue. Okay?
Fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, I'm closing the hearing on 679. Before I open anything else, I want to make a statement. I haven't told the committee this necessarily, or directly, or cumulatively, or in public, but I have been aware that there have been some negotiations going on around the SAFE issue. And I asked everybody from SAFE and Liberty that I could find in the halls in the last few minutes to come in, because I had on this agenda public hearing and possible work session on a whole bunch of SAFE bills. As I understand it, negotiation is give and take. And people from Liberty Northwest and people from SAFE had done some pretty good give and take. You all understand what I'm saying?
Looks like Brian Bowe was on the taking end, though.
Brian Bowe was maybe on the taking, and who knows?
Yeah.
You can say things I can't say. I have no idea. We're not going to go there.
The receiving end.
But what I'm saying is that those... I don't know whether to call them negotiations or whatever, given me some reasons for some hope that accommodations might be made and some compromises might be made. And those things just kind of stopped all of a sudden with a jolt. And I don't know whether people felt that they overextended themselves or what. But what I want to say is we had a work session set for today. I'm going to set a work session for next Thursday. And I have a feeling that I might have to rearrange the already published agenda to make sure we have time on that work session to do some stuff. That'll be up to myself and the Senate President and several others that help determine how we're, you know, they're giving us an impossible number of bills to handle in a very short amount of time. That's why these agendas look so crazy. But next Thursday, I want to have another work session. if people can have some agreements, some amendments that they can agree upon, whether they're written out or, well, I want something written, yeah, whether they've gone through legislative council or not, that's fine. But if people can't reach an agreement, at some point this committee is going to start making sausage without you. Did you hear me? I hope you understand the message. We have serious stuff to do in relationship to SAFE. There's been a public outcry for that. Push the door shut or pull it shut or whatever it takes. Would you, Jesse? Thank you. So I'm hoping that y'all can come back here next Thursday. Those from SAFE, those from Liberty, other interested parties. Is there any objection to this? Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I totally agree with you. We thought things were underway. It may be the fact that we're missing one of the principals' negotiation. We'll be back on Monday, in my understanding. And I think the idea that the committee sends a clear message that we want agreement here of some sort, I think is a good message to send.
Comments?
If at all possible.
Mr. Chair, you're running up against the timeline of April 8th. So, you know, you're going to have to.
That's why I'm saying next Thursday I want a work session.
You won't have a choice, that's right. Even if you're sympathetic.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. With that, we didn't open a work session. I just stated the intent of the group. I know there's a bunch of people from SAFE and Liberty, and they're going to all get up and walk out at the same time. And so we... we'll ask them to please do that as quietly as possible. And where am I? Am I supposed to be opening a hearing on 690?
Yes.
Do we have a sign-up sheet on 690? Yes, we do. I'm going to ask Judith if she will read us a little bit about 690.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Members. Senate Bill 690 permits payment of supplemental unemployment benefits to dislocated workers whose unemployment is due to release from military duty related to deployment in the Oregon National Guard or military reserves in Afghanistan or Iraq. It extends eligibility of dislocated workers for supplemental benefits beyond June 30, 2005. We have the -1 amendments before us. Those amendments modify eligibility requirements such that the lack of employment resulting from the worker's return to service in the Guard or the Reserve following a change in status from serving under Title 32 to serving under Title 10 at a time designated as a period of combatant activities. That's added to the eligibility requirements. It defines eligible dislocated workers to include those returned to service in the Guard or the Reserves following active duty service. In the amendment also would declare an emergency effective on passage. We have a no revenue impact. We still are waiting for word from fiscal on this measure. It's my understanding that the department is considering whether or not they can do this within current service levels, and so they want to work that out so we know whether or not it needs to go to Ways and Means or if it doesn't. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
We've got, guess what? Colonel Mike Caldwell. First time I've heard from him lately, and a guy named McDonald. Gee, let's bring up Tim Nesbitt. There's a new voice. I might even let Tim go first if he wants.
Thank you, Senator, and members of the committee. This began as a modest but important program. Maybe I should say that all dislocated workers face similar challenges getting onto new careers, but they're not all treated equally under federal and state law. So this program arose in 2001 when we were seeing a lot of layoffs of manufacturing workers. And what it does is mirrors the federal program for layoffs that are caused by trade impacts. What's covered here are those other kinds of layoffs, which we identified as the time occurring from not trade-related factors, but things like energy costs and drought and the shift of production to other states. So the program was first established in the 2001 session on a pilot project basis. It was renewed in 03. It's a modest but important program as it currently is structured, covering about 75 to 100 persons per biennium. But it's found that for extensive retraining for a new career, you often need more than 26 weeks. And this extra 26 weeks on top of the traditional 26, again, starts to mirror what the feds do for workers affected by trade impacts, and does so with our own UI Trust Fund. So there's really no general fund cost here, and it's a legitimate use of UI Trust Funds. And as we came forward with the idea of renewing this program once again, it occurred to us that for workers who've been activated by the Guard in reserves, go through that service, whether or not they were employed beforehand, they gain enough credited service in the Guard to qualify for unemployment benefits, but when they come out, are often looking to find work. And if they're in the same situation, we think it's only fair to extend the same program to them. So that's a proposal this time to renew what has worked as a modest but important program in the past two biennia. We need to ask for this to be done on an emergency basis, because otherwise we're facing a June 30th ending date, and to extend the program to returning Reserve and Guard members who were activated in the interim. So we definitely support this with the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you.
We definitely have a good concept here, in my humble opinion. Let's see. Tamara?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tamara Brickman. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department. And without going into repeating what Mr. Nesbitt just said, this program is a program that's currently available for certain types of dislocated workers that are not eligible under the Federal Trade Act programs. Federal law and state law under unemployment insurance law dictate that when a person's on unemployment insurance, they have to, what we call the AAA test, they have to prove on a weekly basis that they're actively seeking work, that they're available for work, and that they're able to work. And federal law allows for a few exceptions of that, and this happens to be one of those areas of law where they allow an exception in order to allow a person who's been dislocated from the workplace to receive training and for a new profession and receive benefits at the same time in order to help supplement the wages that they've lost from being dislocated. And the amendment primarily was drafted in order to make sure that we not only reached those individuals who've been called up to service in Iraq and Afghanistan, but those who have also been called up to service stateside to fill in for those people who have been called overseas. So if you have some people that are called up to active service in the United States as well to serve, that they would also be eligible for this program. And it's the Employment Department Advisory Council, which is a council of 12 individuals appointed by the governor that represent business, labor, and management, equally support this bill. And I just wanted to be here if you had any questions about the program in general.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mike, quick comment.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. We fully support the bill. It's precisely what needs to happen.
Okay. Are there questions about the bill?
I have a question, yes. Mr. Chairman, and it's not exactly related to the bill, but just for my own information. If a person is called into the National Guard under the circumstances that we have today, where they're not going to go for just a few weeks, they're going to go for long terms, what is the responsibility of the employer to that person? Do they have to keep that job for that person as long as they're deployed?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, that is correct. Under the federal law and also state law, it is required of the employer to maintain the position for the individual, what they call the escalator clause. So if the class of individuals were a lot improved in wages and or benefits, then that person comes back to exactly where they would have been had they never left. So they are protected under federal and state law to do exactly that. I think what this bill addresses is a number of issues. One is that the current battalion, out of 600-700 people that we deployed, we've got a count right now at almost 40% of those people are unemployed once they get off active duty. Some of those were unemployed before they left. If you remember, our economy was pretty sluggish. some of those companies that they work for no longer exist. They've been gone 18 months. And we've had that more happen more times than we'd like to think about. They come home, their company's gone, it's been consumed, it's been reorganized. They have no rights then because that company no longer exists. So that federal law doesn't protect them in that sense.
Excuse me for smelling a rat here, but is there any way in which a company might reorganize to get out of an obligation that they have? Have one go away and another one replace it?
We've not seen that as a purpose.
I'm just wondering.
No.
Okay, thank you.
The most egregious one that I've dealt with was a mechanic who worked for a school district. School district elected to get out of the bus business and contract it. And when he was gone, 18 months, in Afghanistan and Iraq, he came back and that company that took on the job, took the contract, said, we have no job for you, and they had no obligation for him.
Right.
And yet he'd served 18 months in very abject combat and risk his life, and it was very traumatic to work that. So we worked with him. We got him into a retraining program through the Workforce Development Office, and he's employed now, but it took a lot of extra work on our part to do that and make sure he was taken care of. I think this will go a long way in helping those kind of folks who either weren't employed when they left when they deployed, or two, they came back and their company no longer exists.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Now, the department wants to wait to see if we can get a minimal or no fiscal on this. Am I correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Tamara Brickman again for the record, legislative coordinator for the Employment Department.
So you want us to hang on to this for a while?
We'd prefer that. The issue is because the program was set to sunset, when we built our budget, we built a budget without the current FTE in it, but we're looking, and our Director of Unemployment Insurance took a well-deserved vacation this week, and so we hadn't had a chance to confer with him on that. So.
We could pass the Dash 1 amendments to take care of that part, couldn't we? You don't want to do that either.
There would be a targeted, but
go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just so that you know, we probably did what we shouldn't have, and we drafted a fiscal state. The fiscal that we would be addressed to the bill with amendments because we knew that there was the drafting didn't get there in the first place. So the fiscal is not going to change based on the amendments. So what I'm saying is if you wanted to go into work session to just adopt amendments and hold on until another time to move it out, you could do that because the fiscal will not change based on the amendments.
Is that okay?
That would be perfect.
Okay. I'm deferring to your wisdom here.
Mr. Chair, certainly it's your prerogative to do whatever you want. Typically, we adopt the amendments so everyone's clear about what they're voting on when you go to the work session to pass it to the floor. And so we typically do that all in the same sitting, but certainly it's your prerogative to do it otherwise.
I don't need to do it. All right. Any other questions? I'm going to close the hearing and wait for a work session when you guys get back to us. 7:58, right? That's where we are now?
That's right. Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 758 exempts military compensation, including death gratuities and other qualified military benefits, from state income taxation. It limits exemption to the Oregon National Guard, the organized militia, and other reserve forces performing service under active duty status. It applies to tax years beginning January 1, 2001, and before January 1, 2006, takes effect on the 91st day after signing die. We have received a minimal fiscal impact. We also have a potential revenue impact because this measure does have a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Colonel Caldwell. Your head must be spinning from all of these this afternoon.
Mr. Chair, it's always a delight to be before you and your committee.
What a diplomatic thing to say.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Colonel Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Clearly anything that would probably be more fitting in my mind is if somebody is killed in the line of duty, then it seems rather ridiculous in my mind that we would tax them and their loved ones for that death gratuity and that death benefit. So we would support that. Having said that, however, as I represent the department for my boss, the governor, it has an impact. I don't think it'd be that great, but if it does have an impact, I would defer to the governor's office before I would say that this is a good thing for the state of Oregon.
Well, it's hard for me to imagine that the governor, who's attended all these funerals, would be against exempting military compensation, including death gratuity and other benefits, from income tax taxation.
Mr. Chairman, I would wholeheartedly agree with you, but I have not spoken to the governor's staff about this, and or nor the governor himself, but my sense is that that would be the case.
I guess we have a due pass, and it goes to revenue. Why?
That's correct. Well, because it is an exemption from taxation, so it is going to have some revenue impact, and that's why it's being
very accrued. Small. But
right.
Okay. Any problems with due pass to revenue? Any other discussion? Let's close the hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 758. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move the Senate Bill 758 be moved to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 758 to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Let's close the hearing on 758 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 792. Colonel Caldwell, you might as well quit moving back and forth unless it just keeps you awake. By the way, you've been here long enough, and you guys in the back of the room, the only ones left can have the cake. There's a big cake up here.
Beautiful cake.
That's your reward for staying so long.
That's right.
A lot, and you should have a piece of cake.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Reagan Military Department. And we certainly do support this particular bill, and we think it would be a good option.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. I'm paying attention now.
No, I'd just like to tell the committee that the Oregon National Guard supports this bill.
How's that?
That's brief. Go ahead.
And just for the record, Mr. Chair, we have a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on the measure.
Okay. Questions, comments, discussion? Good bill should pass, is what I've heard. I'm going to close the hearing on 758, nope, 792. Excuse me, we're moving too fast, and I'm not moving my paper fast enough. 792, Senator George, you're talking to me again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move Senate Bill 792 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, if that's appropriate.
It is appropriate. Senator George moves Senate Bill 792 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion further? Any questions? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered, and I'm sure that Senator Starr will be glad to carry that one.
Certainly.
That's what I thought.
Senator George's name on the top of the
poll.
Oh, it
does? Okay.
No,
he's been carrying them all. I was just spreading it around.
All right.
That's what happens when I'm gone.
That's right. All right. We are now at 798. I'm going to open a hearing on 798. I can't even say the numbers. Judith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate Bill 798 creates the Oregon National Guard Life Insurance Reimbursement Program and the related fund. It appropriates money from the general fund to the Life Insurance Reimbursement Program. It would declare an emergency effective July 1st, 2005. We do not have any amendments before us. We have a no revenue impact, and this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mike?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. This bill is a very good bill, I think. However, it also has, even though the committee didn't get the impact, I know there's an impact, and I don't have it with me. It's
got a blank. So.
Yeah, it's blank, so it doesn't have one, but it has potential impact. If we were to pick up the Serviceman Group Life Insurance, Serviceman Group Life Insurance for the members who are deployed. As a matter of fact, I may have that 2677. Clearly, we would have that $6.27 a month for each one of the members. So, I think we would have some sort of an impact. But I ran off without it. I don't know how I did that, but I did. My memory serves me correct. It's around $300,000. would be the impact.
Biennium?
For this biennium. We have no way of knowing what the next call-ups will be. But if we were looking at it today, what we know has happened, I believe it was 331,000. So there is an impact, and of course it goes to revenue. And again, the governor has $700,000 in his recommended budget to the legislature for National Guard package, as he calls it. And this could clearly be part of that. I know that Mr. Campbell, his policy advisor, and I have talked about that as one of these items. Governor certainly has not been specific with regard to how that $700,000 is spent. He's proposed it, and I think he's left it up to this body to dispose of how that and how that's done in his budget. Again, we support it. We think it's a good deal for our citizen soldiers. I would, however, let you know that House Bill 2677, I think, is identical to this.
Is it already on the way?
It's had a hearing. Yes, sir, it has. I've testified on that, and it did have the impact with it. We asked...
If it's on the way already, then we shouldn't be sitting here spending time on this one, necessarily. I mean, I know Senator George's ego isn't on the line here. Am I correct?
My ego's on the line? No,
isn't on the line.
Oh, isn't on the line. No, that's all I was going to say. All I care about is policy and the statement we're making relative to those who may not be adequately covered.
Okay.
I would recommend, I think, Mr. Chair, that you probably defer to the House bill. It's already had a hearing, and it does have an amendment to it that we asked for in that slight.
In that case, I'm going to close the hearing on 798. We'll wait for the House bill. Okay. The last one of the day is 891. Judith, tell us about it for a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 891 allows an employer credit against their income taxes for amounts paid as compensation to employees who are members of military service, the military reserves, the Oregon National Guard, or other organized militia during periods in which the employees are providing active duty military service. So that actually should be a sentence saying that. So we're covering
everyone.
We're covering everyone.
Yeah. We finally got them all lumped in.
Military reserves, Oregon National Guardsmen, and those in the organized militia and that who are on active military service.
Where's McDonald when we'd like to tell him we got it right?
Right. I've been looking for him.
Probably waiting.
Yeah. This would apply to tax years beginning January 1st, 2005, this past January, and would take effect on the 91st day following adjournment, sine die. We have received a minimal fiscal impact. We have a potential revenue because this, again, does have a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee.
Mr. Chair, could you define other organized militia?
Go ahead.
You're the Colonel. In the Oregon Revised Statutes, if you look at our Constitution, the State of Oregon Constitution, and our federal Constitution, it talks about the militia. About 1910, 1911, Congress basically shifted from the word militia and created what is now currently the modern National Guard. However, the militia is the precursor, and we are a part of that militia. And the Oregon Constitution basically says that the organized militia of the state will consist, or in our statutory language, I should say, will consist of the Oregon National Guard, Army National Guard, Air National Guard, and Oregon State Defense Force. The unorganized militia, by statutory language, is every male 18 to 45 years old within the state of Oregon. So you have the organized militia under the control of the governor and commanded by the adjutant general, and you have the unorganized militia, which is every male 18 to 45.
Not a good enough. Go ahead with your follow-up.
The only thing that I would just comment on is that that term is used rather liberally in the press in reference to a few groups that I'm not sure I would like to devote any benefits to, and so I just want to be sure that we're not putting them in this.
Yeah, we don't want a certain militia out there.
So the real technical term here, that's just kind of the press giving them the organized militia. But that wouldn't entitle them.
No, ma'am, it would not. It's extremely unfortunate that some of these haywire offbeat groups have chosen the term militia because the militia in this nation, the militia predates the active component army, the United States Army, by 154 years. So even before we were a nation, we had a militia. And then the militia became part of our Constitution. In fact, if you read the Federalist Papers, many of the writers in the Federalist Papers, as they were trying to pass the Bill of Rights, they commented about the militia being the backbone of the defense of the nation. Our Constitution says that the federal government will maintain a navy and will raise an army. And the connotation, of course, in the Federalist Papers is they would raise the army from the militia. So what you've been seeing of the National Guard, your earlier comment, being called to duty, is precisely how this nation fought all of its wars until the Cold War. And in the Cold War, we had a constant threat every single day, so the active component grew to a large degree. So we've spent the last 50 years or so, 60 years, in that environment. The previous 250 years, we relied on the militia as a nation to go forth and defend the country. I know you didn't need that history lesson, but
I benefited
from
it.
That's a good one. I just have seen that terminology used in reference to some groups that I would, quite frankly, not support.
I would agree with you.
Colonel Caldwell and I, though, have talked about the idea that we need to broaden this a little bit to literally offer that kind of training to what would be technically a constitutional, well-trained militia, to broaden it out in, you know, in areas of terrorism or a lack of troops to defend the homeland during this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
How often do you testify and get kicked?
Most of the afternoon. Just to, and I guess since this is the last bill, I'll just, if you don't mind, I'll comment on that as well. I think the true relationship of the Oregon National Guard and the militia that we have today, the unorganized militia versus the organized militia,
right,
what you're talking about really is represented in the State Defense Force. There is no requirement to go to federal training. There is no requirement in the Oregon State Defense Force to have served any time on active duty for training or otherwise and go through that system. Mm-hmm. So in essence, we still have
a mechanism.
That mechanism, mm-hmm, that we can invite people in with certain skills that have very good skills that we need, and we've reorganized it in the last year, and I think it's going to be a real good part of our organization.
I want to give Judith a chance to explain an amendment that's just arrived here.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, we have three amendments that are either one or the other. They're mutually exclusive, I should say. You'll see the dash one amendments. These are brought by Senator Starr. Would place, if you look on the first page of the bill, line 13, there's a blank, and so it says the credit shall equal blank percent of the total amount paid as compensation for employment. So this is for the tax credit. The dash ones set it at 50%, the dash two set it at 75%, and the dash three set it at 100%. So those are the amendments before you.
Let me go back to the bill.
I'll just sit here and eat my cake.
So those percentages all relate to the percentage that the compensation that the credit, so they will get a tax credit for either 50%, 75%, or 100% of the total amount paid as compensation for employment to those folks serving.
And colleagues, I'll just comment. I think this is we have a number of Oregonians that are serving overseas, and a lot of them did leave jobs, and we've heard some stories about how what's happened to those jobs when they've been gone. This would provide an incentive to the employer to basically maintain that job, but they would get credit for continue to compensate, because we have members of our servicemen and women who leave families behind who don't have a means of support, and so this would again support the families that are behind, help the business survive, and also help protect that job for when that service person comes back and it's available for them. So I think it's a benefit all the way around. Mm-hmm. The policy choice that I didn't want to necessarily make on my own was what percentage of that credit, do we want to provide? And you know, basically, I picked three numbers, and we can decide that today if the committee wants to do that, or we can send these amendments and this bill with a blank to the Revenue Committee and leave it up to the Revenue Committee to make that call as well. So I lay that on the table for this discussion.
I'm sorry, committee. I've had too many side marks or so this evening.
So the options are leave it blank and let the revenue committee figure out 50, 75, or 100%.
So, what's the will of the committee? I don't have an investment here. I'm looking to you for direction. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I find nothing wrong with us, you know, sending it to revenue, tagging along the dash 1, 2, and 3 amendments and allow them to analyze it and come up with what they believe is the fair number.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
Fair is fine.
Colonel Caldwell, that okay with you?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, your cake's excellent, by the way.
Thank this lady.
Clearly, I think Senator Starr has touched on an important item. I think that regardless of the protections that the federal law has in place and or the state law, we've always heard of subtleties that occur to guardsmen and reservists. I haven't heard those as much, but guardsmen who return back to their positions. And we did some actions in the last session, if you may recall, where we allowed PERS members, currently retired in PERS, to go to local county sheriffs, local police agencies, and fill in with no harm or foul to their PERS. We did that very specifically, but particularly for the small agencies, who then wouldn't become enamored with this new fellow that they brought on, this new policeman or fireman, and then the service member comes back, and suddenly they're subtly put upon, you know, maybe not illegally, but certainly subtly. And I think if you shift that same thought process, that's what this bill does to the non-governmental agencies, and I think it's excellent. The more benefit there is there, the more they're going to be interested in keeping that position open.
Mr. Chair, I don't think you have to be so motivated. There's a certain motivation in doing what's right, and I think it's fair to give some tax credit, but I don't think that you should have to give people everything so that they will step forward and do some things on their own. And I think you'll find a lot of employers that would try to probably do some of the things without any tax credit at all. I know an awful lot of people that do a great many things without that kind of thing. I think it's very fair to give something. But I don't think that it needs to be 100%, for instance, on the tax credit. I think a sensible tax credit is just saying, good job, thank you for doing that. But I really think that employers should be willing to step up and do some things themselves.
Madam Chair, Senator Berger, I would agree that employers have been very good in this state. I'm not suggesting they haven't. Some of the larger employers, the two that come to mind, is Home Depot and Sears. They have made up the difference between a soldier's pay and what they were earning working for them, if it's shorter, and quite often it is. That isn't across the board. And Congress is talking about some federal tax legislation to do similar things to what this bill speaks to. My only comment was that I know for a fact that we've had young men and women come back from deployments, and then they were subtly leaned on because of being gone for 18 months. It does create a difficulty. So any benefit is better than what we have now, so I would suggest that whatever you come up with is better than today.
Sure.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think I shared with you, my wife and I made a decision on a computer based upon what a company was doing for its employees who
right.
were deployed.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, anything that we can do to say, you know, good job, well done, not only for those who have served, but also for those employers who have kind of stood in the gap and helped our families get by during this time of war.
That's right.
And I appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, I had one more comment. The majority of our soldiers that we have in the Oregon National Guard do not work for big business.
Right. Yeah.
They work for small business people.
Yep.
And small business owners suffer the most, say the least, and contribute far more than the big boys do. I
far
can
more
assure
than
you
ever
that.
Be
you're
a
man after my own heart.
Mm-hmm. And it's just simply what I've observed in 17, 18 years in this job. I've observed it time and time and time again. The guy with 5 and 10 and 15 employees just sucks it up and does it, never complains, never says, I got anything coming, you owe me. They just do it. You get to the bigger guys and they say, you know, take care of me, where's my benefit?
Right.
It's always astonished me, absolutely astonished me. But so my point is that the majority of them work there, so the bigger tax break is going to help the little guy, and you know what, I'm all for the little guy.
Mr. Chair, I know those same people.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah. What are we going to do here? Send it the way you're suggesting it with all three and...
Head's nodding.
I think that'll work, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I'm going to close the hearing, open the work session. Senator George?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we send Senate Bill 891 to the Revenue Committee and suggest to them that they may be the wisdom that will determine between the amendments that we are going to send accompanying the bill.
We can't adopt all three amendments. We'll just send them over there and say, you pick.
Yep, you pick.
Okay.
Yep. You got to make the numbers balance.
Wait a minute. That sounds like a fruit farm. You pick. That's okay. Okay. Is that a motion?
Mm-hmm.
All right. How do I repeat that motion? Do you want to try repeating that motion?
Yes.
Judith is going to repeat that motion verbatim.
The motion before us, committee, is that Senator George moves that Senate Bill 891 be passed on to the Revenue Committee by prior reference with a due pass recommendation, and that they consider the dash 1, 2, and 3 amendments during their consideration of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What she said, is there further discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Is that the end of the job tonight?
No.
Nope? You said
nope?
Nope.
Oh, some work is going on. Senator Berger.
Okay. So. Oh, all right. Yes. Mr. Chairman.
Yeah?
I ask for unanimous consent to suspend the rules and allow Senator Berger, Senator Walker, she's not here. Okay, Senator Berger to vote on Senate Bill 758 and 792.
Would you like to vote on Senator, tell her to come on in. Right, I mean, Senator, she's not there.
Did I include Senator Walker in that?
Oh, you did include Senator Walker. Repeat the motion again, yep, so that the good senator can hear it.
I ask for unanimous consent to suspend the rules to allow Senator Berger and Senator Walker to vote on Senate Bill 758 and 792.
Okay, just to throw a curveball at Linda, can you call a roll on those two for these two ladies? I know we did it without roll calls before.
And just for the benefit, if I could, for Senator Berger and Senator Walker, Senate Bill 758 is going to the Revenue Committee, and Senate Bill 792 had a minimal fiscal, no revenue, so that's going right to the floor.
Okay.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
And that was on which bill?
Which bill? You got to call a bill number.
On Senate Bill 758.
Okay. Right.
And then the other one?
And Senate Bill 792.
Aye.
And Senator Berger.
Aye.
Okay.
And thank you, Senator George.
I think that takes care of it. Is there any other business we have to do?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Very quickly, if any of the senators or House members who might be listening to this committee are here tomorrow at about 3:30 in Salem, we have a group of our troops that are coming home, and a bunch of us are going to try to be out there to make sure they get a good welcome home.
That's
if you
great.
Can be there, that'd be terrific.
Thank you for telling us about that.
Actually, maybe, sir, maybe around...
Nine a.m. So,
1 o'clock.
Then 1 o'clock, huh?
Thanks.
Well, for those of us that can't make it, Mike, tell them we're there with them, for them.
And you're all invited to the 31st at 4:30 at Fairgrounds. You should have gotten that in the mail.
Right.
Which is return home ceremony for the student.
Oh, return home. County. Okay, great.
And we sent a.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me.
Return home ceremony the 31st.
My lunch.
One more
Senator
opportunity
Berger.
To wish you very good wishes on your special day, and may you have many, many, many more.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't feel
so old turning 60 since Bates did it 2 weeks ahead of me. Since the doc turned 60, it doesn't feel quite so bad.
Well, might I share with you that every age has wonderful, wonderful things about it. So you can look forward to many, many other years.
Well, my 91-year-old father was out here 2 years ago keeping an eye on me.
He would agree with that.
Yeah, he'd agree with that. Any other business? If not, the committee is adjourned. Thank you for your patience.
The bills.
Very much.